Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is January 25th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Hold the Line, Bum 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 Bum, and IV Isn't Always Required. Ugh, that was awful. And I promised Ming that I would be trying to sing on this episode. Well, our guest skeptic is Dr. Corey Heintz. Corey is an emergency physician in Roanoke, Virginia. He is also the CME editor for Academic Emergency Medicine. Welcome back to the SGEM, Corey.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be back.
Well, this is the first SGEM hot off the press for 2018.
A new year, a new you, right, Ken? I don't know if our listeners know this, but I'm kind of into mountain biking. And there's an annual ride on New Year's Day at a local trail system, Carvin's Cove. This year, it was 18 degrees at the start and didn't break 20. Honestly, I don't know what that is in Celsius, Ken, and don't ask me to convert it. The new me was worried this year that he was going to come with a few fewer fingers and toes than the old one did.
Well, the listeners probably also don't know, because it's a podcast, that you look exactly like James Franco.
Oh, okay.
You've heard that before, haven't you?
A couple of times.
Well, I need to take this opportunity to thank ED superstar nurse Brenda Palsa for the song suggestion, Hold the Line by Toto.
And thanks also to Andy Tagg from Don't Forget the Bubbles, who suggested Don't You Want Me by the Human League, a great song, which I'm sure we'll use sometime in the future.
I'm so glad that you actually attempted to sing it too. Just to remind everybody, though, we pick the papers first, and then we find an awesome 80s song to go along with the episode. Now, it's not that hard because there were so many great songs in the 1980s, but we don't do it the other way around. The paper comes first, and then we pick the music. All right, Corey, give us a case.
All right, Ken, so you're caring for a patient with a fever in the emergency department, and the nurse asks if you want to start an IV line or just draw blood. You think for a minute. Your patient is not tachycardic, they're not vomiting, and the likelihood of discharge is very high.
Well, emergency department patients often have peripheral IV cannula, or PIVCs, placed at triage for initial blood draws, or just in case they need to be used later in the emergency department stay or hospitalization. It is one of the most commonly performed procedures in the emergency department.
Unfortunately, just like any other procedure, peripheral IVC placement has some downsides. It can lead to discomfort, infection, and the use of time and other ED resources. Some studies report that up to half of those placed in the ED are never used.
So, Corey, what's the clinical question?
Can an educational intervention on the appropriate use and placement of peripheral IV catheters reduce the number of unnecessary IVs placed?
And the reference?
Hawkins et al., Peripheral Intravenous Cannula Insertion and Use in the Emergency Department, an Intervention Study, published in Academic Emergency Medicine in January 2018.
Oh yes, it is hot off the press. All right, let's run through that PICO. What was the population?
Emergency department patients greater than 17 years old.
Yeah, and then they excluded patients who had a triage category 1, or they had their IV inserted by EMS, or they were transferred from another hospital. What was the specific intervention?
The authors performed a 10-week educational training, had change champions, departmental advertising, surveillance, and feedback.
And what did they compare it to?
Pre-intervention data was collected for 12 days before and 12 and a half days after the intervention. Post-intervention data was collected 1 month after the intervention.
All right, let's run through the outcomes. And I said outcomes. What were the primary outcomes?
Well, as you know, Ken,
there can be only one.
But their primary outcome was the reduction in peripheral IV catheters placed post-intervention and their usage.
And how about the secondary outcome?
Peripheral IV catheter insertion cost, including staff and consumables.
Well, we did mention earlier, Corey, that this is an SGEM Hop episode. So we have the lead author on the show, and it's my pleasure to welcome Tracy Hawkins. Tracy is a clinical nurse and researcher in the Emergency and Trauma Center at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital in Queensland, Australia. Since 2008, she has been undertaking research into innovative models of cardiovascular care, peripheral intravenous cannulation, and emergency care. Welcome to the SGEM, Tracy.
Good morning, Ken and Corey. Thanks for the invitation. Today is Australia Day here on the 26th of January.
So we've actually gone across the international date line. So we're recording this on the 25th, but you're in the 26th. So this is really hot off the press. This is like spanning time zones and everything. But we really appreciate you taking time on Australia Day, because we understand that's a really big family holiday there. Sort of like maybe Thanksgiving here or the 4th of July down in the States.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, yes.
Well, there's family, there's barbecue, there's beverages.
Definitely beverages.
So you're recording this on the 26th and we're recording on the 25th. Ken, my mind is blown.
Just blew everybody's mind, didn't I?
I didn't think we were there yet, but I guess we are. So, Tracy, what got you interested in this area of research?
Yes, well, it's a good question, really. Two reasons. My pet hate for waste would be the first reason, both the waste of material resources and time. The second, and probably the main reason, was that cannulas cause pain and have risk, and I believe that our ED clinicians sometimes undervalue these issues, probably because they're so routinely inserted.
So one of the really cool things about the SGEM HOP process is getting the author to read their own conclusions. So Tracy, will you do us the honor of reading the conclusions from your paper?
Oh, sure. So the intervention reduced the POVC placement in the ED and increased the percentage of POVC placed that were used. This program benefited patients and health services alike, with potential for large cost savings.
So now, Tracy, you get to sit back, relax, enjoy, while we go through the quality checklist for observational studies and the key results. And then we'll bring you back to talk nerdy. All right, so Corey, the first question in the observational study checklist is, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, Ken, it did.
Did the authors use the appropriate method to answer their question?
A little unsure on this one.
Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes, they were.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Unsure. It's a little hard to tell how many staff were trained or exposed, although most likely everybody would see the signs or shirts, even if they didn't do the intervention itself.
All right, number five. Was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
Unsure.
Was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes.
How precise are the results?
Well, there were fairly tight confidence intervals around the point estimates, with the range of about 3-5%, so pretty precise.
Do you believe the results, Corey?
I do.
Do you think that they can be applied to your local population?
Unsure, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later for sure.
And the last question, do the results fit with other available evidence?
Yes, they do.
All right, let's get to those key results. They recruited just over 4,000 patients into the study with a mean age of about 37 years. They had a close to 50-50 male-female split, and more than two-thirds of all the PIVCs were placed for administration of IV fluids or drugs. Corey, what was the overall result?
Well, in the big picture, Ken, the educational intervention decreased the number of PIVCs and increased the utilization of those which were inserted.
All right, let's drill down on that a bit and look at the primary outcomes. First of all, there's the PIVC placement issue.
So there were 42% placed before and 32% of patients had them placed after, for about a 10% drop, which makes it pretty easy math for a number needed to treat of 10.
You did that all in your head. I saw that.
I did.
Wow, that was good. Okay, how about PIVC utilization?
Within the ED, about 67% were used before and about 80% after, which gives you, again, a number needed to treat of 8.
And how about within the first 24 hours of admission?
70% before and 83% after, again, for an NNT of 8.
All right, when you look at the secondary outcomes, it would cost less if you did not put in a PIVC, and it was quantified in Australian dollars of about $4,700 over 2 weeks. Now, Corey, like me, you probably have no idea how many U.S. dollars that would be.
I assume it's like 50 or 80.
Do you have any idea?
I don't know.
I actually looked it up because that's how nerdy I am. And it would be about $3,800 US. And then I went to, okay, I wonder what it would be in Canadian. Guess what? We have about a 1-to-1 exchange now. About, again, $4,700 Canadian over a 2-week period. But let's bring Tracy back in, because it's time to talk nerdy. Now, you've already mentioned we're not going to go anywhere near that multiple primary outcomes, because
there can be only one.
However, let's ask Tracy some questions about this study, and rather than the typical five, we're going to go through 10. And I get the first question to lead it off, and that's the Hawthorne effect. A challenge of studies using this methodology is the risk of a Hawthorne effect. Now, Tracy, you used interrupted time series analysis or segmented regression analysis, and we'll put a link in the show notes so people can understand those terms more. And you used this to determine if there was such an effect present. Can you explain this technique, why you used it, and what you found?
Yeah, sure. So this was certainly something we considered. The interrupted time series analysis sought to identify whether there was a quantitative change in the cannula insertion after the rollout of the intervention, or whether there was a gradual change in rate across the data collection period, potentially due to the Hawthorne effect. The insertion rate was noted in the pre-intervention period to identify the trend in the insertion prior to the intervention. Then, after the intervention, to determine whether there was a reduction in the insertion rates upon the rollout. We found that the insertion rates were stable pre and post intervention, but there was a decrease in the insertion rates after the intervention. The clinical and research staffs were blinded to the study, in particular the intervention. In the post intervention data, it was shown that there was an immediate decrease in the insertion and an increase in those inserted being used. This change then remained for the period. We really wanted to see if the change could be sustained, albeit the short period of between the intervention and the post-intervention periods.
Thanks for explaining that, Tracy. And we'll put in links to the Hawthorne effect. And again, like I said, we'll put in a link to that interrupted time series analysis or segmented regression analysis. Corey, you get the second question.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up on that first one. That was definitely a question I had for sure. Second issue we wanted to talk about was the right number of peripheral IVs placed. You clearly state that there are no accepted guidelines on when to place an IV in the emergency department. You used a target of 80% from data coming out of Monash University. The reference for this is a letter to the editor describing a survey that was conducted. The majority of the respondents were nurses, and only about 24% were emergency physicians. We reached out to the author of the letter to the editor, and this survey was not published in a peer-reviewed journal. So we really don't know how many peripheral IV starts are the right number, or how much utilization is the right amount. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So the 80% was really a trigger or a way for people, for us to promote a mantra of being 80% sure. So you're greater than 50% sure it's going to be used, but you're not 100%. It really just was a nice approach to supported clinical decision making.
Okay. I guess thinking about it a little bit, my question when I was reading it was, okay, so if I want somebody to need an IV, I might give them an 80% chance, when if there's no real way to quantify that number.
No, and that's right. We didn't really see, we saw trends in the data, but certainly nothing to hang your hat on, as in this demographic was more likely to have a cannula that was used versus this demographic didn't. I believe that ED clinicians are very well educated, intelligent and dynamic human beings, for the most part, really have the best interest of the patient at heart. So I thought the mantra of asking the question, are you 80% sure your hemodynamically stable patient will have the IV used in the next 24 hours, prompted them to stop and think prior to inserting the cannula. It was a moment in time prompting mindfulness to a task, which in our department had become a culture of automatic. It's the very reason we decided to go down this track of avoiding a pathway-driven intervention. I think sometimes as clinicians, we roll our eyes and think, oh, Lord, not another pathway. You know, what pathway is this patient on? And I just thought if I could have something really positive and something that just promoted in your clinical practice, it didn't involve any paperwork, it didn't involve anything other than, hang on, I'm going to put this cannula in. What are we going to use it for?
Excellent point.
Well, another important detail about that was, why was the IV started in the first place? having an IV just in case in 25 patients who might have hyperkalemia and therefore need urgent management, or those who are bradycardic, seems reasonable, even if none of them are used. On the other hand, having an IV in place because of the cellulitis might be given antibiotics, seems avoidable. Do you have any granular details on the reason for the IV placement?
Like I referred to, we don't, but we do see trends in our data. However, I really would emphasize the fact that I think in emergency medicine, and when I refer to emergency medicine, I include the nurses and the whole team. Clinically, every case stands alone. And I mean, you can learn about, you know, a certain disease process, but really until you've got that patient in front of you, you are the clinician looking after them, you are entitled to make the decision in the best interest of your patient.
So what you're talking about is individual patient care. I love it.
And value patient care. Because I think in the first world of medicine, or in our first world where we're very fortunate to live, sometimes things are just too easy to get access to.
Speaking of value, the third issue we wanted to talk about was the idea of cost, time, and failure rate. You looked at cost savings of PIVC placement and estimated the savings of about $2,500 Australian dollars per week, with a per IV staff time of $16 and average insertion time of 15 minutes. That's $60 an hour, which seems kind of high. Can you comment on nurse pay in Australia?
Yes, I can. It's probably not enough, but to be serious though, per hour is exactly what it costs to employ a nurse with on costs. So that's holiday pay, sick pay, superannuation, and that's within Queensland. Unfortunately, it's not what the nurse has in their pocket at the end of the day. But yes, $60. Australia is, you know, an expensive place to live.
Well, you had an intervention that included education and training, change champions, advertising and surveillance and feedback. How much did this cost? And we want to know the special shirts that you had. Both Corey and I, we want one of those shirts. And it says, are you 80% sure? Corey and I were talking about this earlier. We both want one of those golf shirts, by the way.
Pretty much everybody wants swag.
Oh, swag for sure. Would this offset any financial gains, the cost going into this?
So the shirts and the printing cost in Australian dollars, $500, which this morning as you alluded to, I was also a nerd and looked it up, and it was $403 this morning. So the education and training was done within the clinical time with the support of our directors, which was gratefully received from us. This is the whole beauty of this intervention. It was so simple and it was reproducible. It was applicable across the disciplines. And essential that we do that, because you really need to engage your stakeholders. The shirts, back of the shirt that you see in the article, is this. It reflects our traffic speed signs, and all it had was the 80 and then "Are you sure?" underneath it. So it didn't say anything about a cannula or anything, but it was really a way to prompt a conversation. It was a marketing gimmick, really, that is about making people ask, so what is that on your back, and why should I be sure? And it opens up a conversation.
Well, it opened up a conversation with Corey and I about how we wanted one of these nice golf shirts, and we have yet to hear from you, Tracy, that they are available.
I could arrange something, yes, definitely.
Well, Tracy, we also wondered a little bit about the insertion time of 15 minutes. This seems like a fairly long time to start an IV, and what about the 30% failure rate on the first attempt? That's also a lot higher than we typically see. Are experienced nurses placing these IVs or trainees? We understand that in Australia, IVs are often done by trainees, whereas they're exclusively done by nurses where we work. Did that affect their results?
Yeah, I also was surprised. I had read some literature around timing for cannulation. And of course, a lot of our literature comes, you know, from the military. And so when I got these results, I was surprised. The study was undertaken in what I believe you refer to as a university hospital, but it's a mm-hmm. tertiary level teaching hospital. And there's an expectation to train. We actually have no dedicated IV team in our emergency department or in our hospital. The nursing staff have varying levels of skill, some of them, you know, 30 plus years and with experience in neonates and all sorts of things, not that we see them very often. But in our cohort, just under half the cannula attempts were done by junior doctors. And they could be, you know, day one, week one, or they could be, you know, 3 or 4 years in. So varying levels of experience. The first successful attempts averaged 9 minutes. I think you should know that the timing started with the consenting of the patient. It included gathering the equipment and opening the equipment. And it went until the cannula was secured. So I think 9 minutes is reasonable when you consider that. The sample size was relatively small, which may have influenced the result as well. It's definitely a place where we could do more work and have another look. It's very interesting, I think.
You would also be curious to see, you know, you said on the first attempt average was 9 minutes. I'm thinking in my head of my shift today where the majority of patients got IVs placed quickly, and then there were a few who took 30 minutes, 45 yeah. minutes, however long, because of difficult IV placement, and that's really going to skew your average.
Exactly, and that's exactly what happened. And also we have an escalation process where, you know, the junior doctor might have two goes and then they speak to the nurse and it takes a little while, and then mm-hmm. the registrar comes along and he or she might have two or three goes and then get the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and in 66, you know, cases, it doesn't take much to skew the data.
Let's move on to question number 4, and that's about external validity. This was a single center tertiary care emergency department in Australia. And different countries have different healthcare systems with different expectations of patients. Do you think this study has external validity to non-tertiary centers in Australia or emergency departments outside of Australia?
I think the first question should be, is this an issue in your department, in your emergency department? As an emergency nurse, I seem to be removing cannulas very often. The patient would often comment that they were pleased it was gone and that they were not sure why it was there in the first place. And that was alarming to me. So to answer your question, each department has different cultural norms. Our movement towards value healthcare has prompted our sustained engagement, and I think it is very much applicable to a department that feels it could improve their cannulation practice.
I think that's a great answer, because it's almost like you're providing individual patient care, but then you're speaking about what does your actual department have. And so whether or not it has external validity would all depend on whether or not your department was having an issue with starting cannulas too often and not using them.
Exactly. So do you even have a problem would be the first question, and then go from there. Do you feel your staff would be open to considering the risks and costs of cannulation? Is it something that you could get stakeholders engaged with?
So the first step in change is admitting you have a problem.
Yes.
So let's talk for a second about the longevity of the intervention. You measured the outcome 1 month after the 10-week intervention. Do you think that the 10% improvement you observed will be maintained long-term? And if not, how would that change the cost if you had to do an ongoing intervention to decrease unnecessary catheters over time?
Culturally, we feel that there's an awareness in our department now. We're hoping to audit again soon, so it'll be interesting to see the figures. We believe the benefits are ongoing, with some very gratefully received funds from the Choosing Wisely Australia initiative to brand our scrubs of our clinical champions. recently I did a small presentation and won a voucher for coffee. So the champions are fueled up and ready to go.
Did I just hear you say that there are going to be scrubs with the Are You 80% Sure logo on it?
You've just upped your game, haven't you?
I'll take, what are they called, long blacks or tall blacks? I'll take the coffee, though, too.
I know, the coffee nice.
You may laugh, but to our clinical staff, it's the little things that count. I think you shouldn't underestimate.
Oh, no, it's little things that are great. I mean, there's that book called Nudge, and you just have to give people a little bit of a nudge and showing them that you care, and having that coffee or gamifying it or some of the things that you've done can make a big difference. It doesn't have to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, and I think it also, it shouldn't be not fun. I think it's definitely got to be fun.
So let's talk about shifting the PIVCs to the ward. You did not measure starting an IV on the ward, so could you have just not started it in the emergency department and then pushed it downstream to the inpatient unit?
I could say something really cheeky, but I won't. So most of the avoided cannulas were in patients who were discharged, so I believe the right cohort was addressed, really. So to answer your question, if the patient did require a cannula on the ward, then I surmise that it can be just as easily done there. I think we should support our clinicians if they've made the decision they were 80% sure, that there's always the 20% unsureness. So cut some slack, be supportive of one another. And the patient in the ward may even have a bed to lie on when their cannula is inserted, whereas in our department, sometimes they're sat in a chair.
And the inpatient ward might be happy that the patient didn't come up with a whole bunch of tangled lines that they have to untangle.
Exactly. So we hope it prompts our colleagues to consider other approaches. Plus, the patient's not had a cannula sitting in their arm for days on end unused, and therefore avoids the pain and the risk of infection and the 9 to 15 minutes of emergency staff time.
So our next topic is going to be about surrogate outcomes. You didn't actually measure the harms of peripheral IVC placement itself. Are you assuming that the 10% net decrease in IV catheters would translate into a decrease in clinically important harms? It appears that patients were being poked for blood work anyway. What's the real harm of an IV left in place for 2 hours in the ED and then removed?
This is a question I get. There is harm because you're hurting someone for no reason. They do hurt. And so there's the issue of infection or potential for infection as well. There's also the cost of cannulation versus venipuncture. Poking someone for blood work and removing the pokey thing is much more comfortable than having the cannula sit in your arm. There's also some evidence that samples taken from cannulas are more likely to be hemolyzed. So just to add another dimension, so an inaccurate result is not timely or, can lead to treatment being delayed. So more study needs to be done around the failure of cannulas post-blood draw as well. We don't really know whether it's the right thing to do. So one question always leads to another.
Certainly. You mentioned having the cannula in place in their arm. It always amazes me that in 2018, I'm still telling patients that there's not a needle there.
I know. It's the education of our patients as well. Why do they come to the emergency department expecting a cannula even? Managing our patient expectations is interesting, though. A small study that's been done by colleagues of mine, which is not yet published, but there is some evidence that patients would prefer to be poked twice rather than get a cannula. So I think that's going to be really interesting to read that. So when I talk to my staff, I say some things are only for in and some things are only for out. So I leave it to the staff to decide, is this enough an emergency to warrant taking the blood from the cannula, or do you think I can just venesection and then, if the patient becomes unstable, then put the cannula in. Or if you think they're going to need a contrast CT or, put it in at the right time is really what we need to talk about.
I'm glad you mentioned harms and adverse events. if there's not going to be a benefit from starting the IV, then even if the harm was minor or rare, we shouldn't accept any harm.
I agree. I always try to think along the lines of, this is my mum. And often our patients are not just a one-off patient, not a one-off visit. These patients come multiple times, our oncology patients. And so what are we doing to them over their journey?
It's a nice way to frame it. Think of it as your mom. Let's move on to number 8, though, and this is about clinical gestalt. Did you consider measuring clinical gestalt? Perhaps there were some clinicians that were starting IVs all the time, and there were others on the opposite end of the spectrum. It would have been interesting to know the individual clinician's ability to predict IV utilization. This could identify a potential knowledge gap, and you could focus your interventions on those individuals rather than everyone.
Yeah, a couple of things. Turnover of our staff in our department is relatively high. So I believe the logistics of this would be very difficult. Our junior doctors do, reasonably short time in the emergency department. They might be there 10 to 12 weeks. Interventions that target individuals tend not to change the culture, which is what we attempted to do. This intervention was about challenging the culture of the just-in-case cannula. The intervention was always promoted as being a positive and an empowering campaign to support our staff and to make a decision not to do something. So ED staff, as you know, like our clinicians, it's crazy busy. It's noisy. It's a decision-heavy environment. It can be very intense. So sometimes making the decision not to do something is really difficult. And there's this term bandied around in literature recently called deliberate clinical inertia. I believe this aligns with our value healthcare, so where we support and share the decision making. It's essential for this concept.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you. So moving on to number 9, let's talk about your power calculation. You powered your study based on an estimated prevalence of 65% based on a local audit. Your actual pre-intervention prevalence was 23% lower at 42%. Could it be that it got out that you were doing this study and clinicians started fewer IV catheters? That would have been a very cost-effective strategy, with announcing a study had more than double the impact.
Two things. So the audit for the power calculation was based on an audit done by one person over a 12-hour period, greater than 12 hours, 12 months prior to the study. In saying that, we excluded our higher acuity patients, so we believe that the cannula was warranted. And the transient nature of our staff meant that probably about one-third of the staff that were present during the audit were probably not there when the study was commenced. Fortunately, not much leaks out of my research office. on a serious note, though, the study was powered to get precise numbers on utilization and was overpowered for detection on an insertion.
Well, you just answered my follow-up question about the lower prevalence and higher utilization, whether that impacted your sample size calculation and if the study was still adequately powered, but it sounds like you overpowered the study to begin with.
And the reason for that, it was very difficult to know how many we were putting in that weren't used because of our documentation issues. So we were moving from paper-based notes to integrated electronic medical notes. And that was a time of transition and, like all things, timing is everything. I still don't think we document our cannula insertions very well. So it was very difficult to see the patients that got the cannula that then wasn't used at all. They just weren't in the notes when you did a retrospective chart audit. So it's interesting. Interesting phenomena happened.
So let's talk a little bit about harms. Are there any harms to this intervention? Were there patients who needed an urgent IV medication which was delayed because an IV wasn't readily available? How many patients had to be poked twice because of the new protocol, once for blood work and then later for the IV?
The cohort of patients that get cannulas still got poked for blood on their patient journey. So even if blood was taken when the cannula was inserted, there's a very good chance the patient went to a ward and would be poked multiple times on their journey. So I think having a cannula in situ doesn't prevent pain. It probably causes pain. Yeah, it doesn't prevent you being poked more. I think it's more likely that patients were still being poked for no reason. If the clinicians thought it 80% likely that the cannula would be used, then sure, they'd place the cannula. And if then things changed, then we're very, very skilled and dynamic environment where, you know, we love it. We love a bit of excitement. That's why we work in this field.
Well, the other side of that is that the prior research demonstrated that IVs were only being used about 50% of the time. However, in your pre-intervention phase, you were using IVs two-thirds of the time. So you were already like about 17% better. So good for you. But the intervention only improved that by another 12%. Again, could a more cost-effective strategy just be announcing that you're going to do this study on utilization of PIVCs? So you better be sure.
Yeah, I'll go around making all sorts of threats. I don't think it'll make me very popular, but I can give it a go. The staff were blinded to the study question and the intervention, so I don't think they really, they're so busy they wouldn't even look up from whatever they were doing on a day-to-day basis. I'm not saying no one in our department had interest in research, but no one asked me. The prior research had used a combination of audits and retrospective chart review, which I talked about the limitations just a few minutes ago, but it was the documentation inaccuracy. It makes it challenging. We used a very robust methodology to get accurate figures, and we think this might account for the numbers. This methodology comes at a price. Research is expensive. We were really, really grateful to receive funding from our Emergency Medicine Foundation.
Well, thanks, Tracy. Those are all of our nerdy questions. Do you have anything else you'd like to tell the SGEMRAs about your study?
Oh, thank you very much for listening. I think everyone worries about the harm done by not having a cannula. The belief that the just-in-case cannula is necessary because the patient may deteriorate, when in actual fact our ED clinicians, I mean doctors and nurses, place IVs all the time in unstable patients. And I'd suggest that ED environment patients are closely monitored and clinicians work as a team to address deterioration and medication requirements. Conversely, I think not a lot of thought goes into potential pain and harm we're doing. So the mantra and the branding was really important. So are you 80% sure that your hemodynamically stable patient will have an IV use in the next 24 hours? Really was a positive way to approach this. It gave the clinician a permission to make the conscious decision, and a culture of change within any workplace is slow and difficult. We know education works. It's about timely delivery and a positive and empowering experience. So thank you very much, and I'm very happy to share my details for questions and feedback if anybody wants to talk to me. I'm very chatty.
That would be great. We'll bring you back at the end so you can do the SGEM tagline. But until then, Corey, can you comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions?
We generally agree with the authors, Ken.
Can you give us a bottom line then?
Educational interventions can reduce the number of peripheral IV catheters placed in the emergency department setting and increase the proportion of peripheral IV catheters that are ultimately used, but the longevity of such an intervention and the patient-oriented benefit is not 100% clear.
And can you give a case resolution?
You tell the nurse not to start an IV at this point, as your prediction of it being used is significantly less than 80%. You will reassess later during the patient's visit.
And how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically?
Reducing unnecessary IV insertion can potentially increase patient comfort, reduce infections, and reduce costs.
And what are you going to tell your specific patient? How are you going to translate this research into the bedside?
You say that for now, you're not going to have an IV started, but if the clinical picture changes, your decision may change.
It's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and last week's winner was Kyle DeWitt, a PharmD from the University of Vermont Medical Center. Kyle knew that cortisol is the main glucocorticoid and aldosterone is the main mineral corticoid. Corticoid. There, I got it out. All right, what's the question this week?
Who was the first physician to use intravenous fluids and for what indication?
If you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. And if you've played before, I just ordered some new cool skeptical prizes, so it's not the same as the old skeptical prizes. I think you'll like it. So if you won before, try to win again.
Hey, SGEMers, it's Justin Morgenstern. Now it's your turn to get involved. What are your thoughts? Tweet your comments using the hashtag SGEMHOP. Do you have any questions for Tracy Hawkins and her team? Ask them on the SGEM blog. The best social media feedback will be published in AEM. This is the easiest way I know to get involved in discussing the medical literature and to see your name in a top-tier publication like Academic Emergency Medicine. I'm looking forward to reading your comments.
Also, don't forget that those of you who are subscribers to Academic Emergency Medicine can head over to the AEM homepage to get CME credit for this podcast and article. We'll put the process on the SGEM blog. Just a quick conference update about the SAEM meeting this year being held in Indianapolis, May 15th through 18th, 2018.
Yeah, you could meet Jeff Klein there, Chris Carpenter, the smartest guy in the room, Esther Chu, Megan Rainey, a whole bunch of people from AEM. So consider coming to Indy in May. Well, thanks, Corey, for doing another SGEM hop to start off 2018.
You're welcome, Ken. It's always a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to the next year.
And thank you, Tracy, for coming on the SGEM and telling us how we could hold the line.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you read the SGEM tagline? But I want you to do it in your best Australian accent.
Mate, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.